Welcome, dear listeners, to this week's Afternoon Satsang. As always, this is Prem from Team Radio Sai, and with me is Brother Arvind, and we are here to take you through this week's Afternoon Satsang. And the last couple of weeks, we spoke about the Bhagavat Vahini, so which means that this week it's going to be a Bhagavatam of a different kind, a Bhagavatam, of course, centered on Swami as always, but on a very general theme. And we are happy that this is a theme which was requested by one of our listeners. It's always nice to dwell upon a theme which is sought. So in that sense, we are happy to deal with this theme. But before we introduce the theme, as always, let us begin by offering our most humble pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. And we pray that Swami guides us through whatever we share in the course of this satsang. And let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sai Ram, Arvind.
Sai Ram, Prem. And as you rightly put it, as we begin this new month, it's amazing to have a new theme that has been, sought by one of our listeners. It's very encouraging when our listeners seek a theme. And it has made us go into the theme, read about it, think about it. And as always, by Bhagwan's grace, it has been a beautiful inspiration. And dear listeners, we hope that we will be able to share that inspiration with all of you. Now, in introduction of this theme, let me take you all back to the Dwapar Yuga, when Bhagwan Krishna made a promise to Arjuna. He said, Ananyas chintayanto mam, yejana paryupasate, tesham nityabhiyuktanam yogakshemam vahamyaham. In short, it means that if you give up all other activity, all other thought and focus on me and me alone, then you don't worry, I shall take care of your progress in all ways, you know, including the most important, which is the spiritual way. Prem, when I heard this, when I read the translation of this statement, actually discouraged me, you know, because Krishna puts an if condition and then what happens? We always see the then what happens part and get enamored, wherein he says that I will take care of everything of yours, all sorts of progress, you need not worry. But the if condition is quite stringent and strict, you know. The if condition says that you don't think of anything else, only me, and then I will do all these. So I was just thinking that had that condition, had that kind of promise been given to us people in the Kali Yuga, none of us would have qualified for that scheme, I think. You know? Krishna would not have had any takers for that scheme. It is in contrast to that, that today's theme, you know, is so heartening, and it makes us aware of how the Lord has become more compassionate when it comes to Kali Yuga. In Kali Yuga, what Swami says is, if you need me, you deserve me. That's it. It is not like you have to incessantly think of me and nothing else and then I will give myself to you. To start off with, Swami says, if you need me, you deserve me. And that, dear listeners, is the theme for today. The interesting thing is, while it is definitely a kind of hand-holding and a much easier step than Ananyas Chintayanto Mam, when both Prem and myself went deep into this and tried to discover the hidden meanings and what it actually means, it was inspirational. At the same time, we realized that the Lord has not lowered his standards too much. It is just that he has introduced a few more, possibly primary and kindergarten classes, so that he can hold our hand for a longer time. But ultimately, it is also quite a strict and stringent condition. If you need me, you deserve me. So that will be the theme for today, and we hope that you will enjoy this journey along with us. And that is where we'll take it up from, the theme, if you need me, you deserve me.
Just going to back to that shloka from the Bhagavad Gita, I think it's, I mean, as you said, it's scary at the same time, it is so encouraging. And I think much of what we're going to speak today is about that. Because if you look at it, you know, Swami is saying that Ananyas Chintayanto Mam, if you don't think of anything else, putting it that way, it sounds a little scary, that you don't think of anything else, think only of me. But if you look at it this way, that you don't have to think of anything else, I'm just asking you to think of one thing. You don't have to worry about 100 things and 100 conditions and 100 pitfalls or anything, just think of me. So I'm making it so much more easier. And I think that is the ease which the Bhakti Marga itself offers. where you do not have to, it's like sitting in the passenger seat of a cab versus sitting in the driver's seat in a crowded Indian road. And you know how much difference it makes. You can just sit back and you can probably listen to music. You can do your work just with the idea that...
Enjoy the scenery around.
Right, I don't have to worry about taking every turn and slowing and then worrying about the lights. I think that's what it is. And that one shloka has got so many meanings. And probably one thing which I'd like to tell here, why it is important. You know, it's not that this topic, like if you need me, you deserve me, is meant only for the beginners or only for those who are coming to know of Swami and how do you get Swami into your life now. It is not only for them. It's for even the person who is at the doorstep of liberation, if you could say that. Because as somebody very beautifully explained this, yoga kshemam mahamyaham. You know, yoga is union with God, as the definition goes. And kshema is well-being, right? So one thing is to look at it as it gives you the ultimate as well as what is the immediate worldly necessity. The other way of looking at it is, it's yoga and yoga kshema, which means it takes you to the destination and it helps you retain what you've got also. And that is a very, very important thing because as Swami would say, that you could fall from any step in the path. And not only should God help you in your progress, but He should also help you in holding on to where you've reached already. And that is why this need me, you deserve me is something which is important for us. Till the point that there is no you and me, there is that unity. I think that's the only place where you are completely secure. If not for that, I think you need Swami all through the journey, and I think that's very important for us to know.
Perfectly put, Prem. As you said, it is relevant for the beginner as well as for the graduate, if I can put it that way. While Ananya Chintayantoma appears to be for those from grade 1 to the graduation, if you need me, you deserve me, appears to be something that is relevant like from kindergarten itself, from play school itself till graduation. So that is the compassion of our Bhagwan. Before, you know, we go into further details, it'll be interesting to define this word need. You know, in economics, often there is a definition of this word need. And another word that comes almost every time along with the need, which is want. Need versus want. And to start off our discussion, I think the economic definition itself is quite profound and meaningful and a good starting point. The economic definition says that something that is required to survive is need. It's like without that the person dies, a person can't survive. That is a need. And something that people desire to have is a want, but they may or may not get it. In the economic definition itself, there is so much of meaning that holds true for our life and spiritual path also. I mean, when I say I need God, when Swami says, if you need me, you deserve me, going by the economic definition itself, when I say I need God, it must be that without God, I will die. Without God, I am not able to survive. That is what is meant by needing. Versus wanting. Wanting is something that you desire, but you may or may not obtain it. That itself says, if God is an option in my life, if Swami is just an option in my life, that is, I would like to have Him. It is nice if He is there. As the definition of want goes, you may or may not get it. So if God is an option in my life, I may or may not attain Him. But if He is my need, it means that without God, I am unable to survive. My life is as good as death. I think we can take a lot of meaning and understanding from the economic definition of need and want itself.
Absolutely. I think that is the basic importance we need to remember. But going by that, we go through life thinking that a lot of things are needs, but very few things are actually needs. You know, we always go back to that, what you say in Hindi is roti, kapda or makhan, or what you say as food,
clothing
and shelter. That is the basic need at all times. But you know, there are a lot of things which make some things a need, which may not be a need. Probably we'll come to that right in the end, where we talk about how we can create needs of things which probably is not a need for somebody else. Needs are not always universal. But that is what it is. You know, if most of us, as again going back to the Bhagavad Gita, you say artha, arthati and jignasu. A lot of people need God, but it's almost like a secondary need. I have some needs, but I need something to ensure that what I need is intact, or what I need, what I've got is secure. And I think that is when you're looking to God as probably that binding agent, which is eventually helping you hold on to what you've already held on. That is where we start. And when we do that, I think that is where our relation with Swami is at that point in time. I think that is the importance of really asking ourselves, what is the difference between need and want? And of course, this is in context of our relationship with Swami. But even otherwise, if we keep looking at ourselves and saying that, is this something I really need? Is this something I want? Or is this something which it's a necessity? I think automatically, I think we'll drop a lot of things from our life.
You know, speaking of which, I'm reminded of a Chinnakatha, a lovely story. It has been narrated in different variants. Here is one variant. It goes that there was this disciple who was very eager to see God. And so he goes to his guru, his master, and he tells him that, Master, I need only one thing. I need to see God. I just need to see God. And the master says, if you need to see God, you will definitely see him. And he puts him on a spiritual regimen. The disciple tries and does it for a long time, and he is not unable to see God. So he comes back to the master and he says, Master, I am not able to see God irrespective of what you had promised me. Now it's high time you show me God, because I am not able to see God and I need to see God. The master says, okay, tomorrow morning will be the day you see God. So the disciple is very excited. The master says, be ready, be by the river, I'll be coming there and I'll show you God. And this disciple is so excited, he's so, you know, he's unable to sleep throughout the whole night. The morning he wakes up, he doesn't care whether he had a proper sleep or not, because he's so excited, because this is the day he has been waiting for. He goes to the riverbank and the guru comes there. And then the guru tells him that, get into the water, do your prayers facing the sun, and I shall do what I need to do. The disciple, in all his excitement, joy and anticipation, stands in the river, waist deep water, and facing the sun, begins his oblations and prayers, and he's closing his eyes. And when he's like this, he's suddenly caught unawares, because his guru comes up from behind him and just pushes him into the water. Though the water is only waist deep, the guru pushes him inside, and the disciple is shocked. He's wondering what the guru is doing. But he gives him the benefit of doubt. He thinks possibly this is part of the process of seeing God. And he's underwater now. He's holding his breath and he's thinking, maybe in few seconds my guru will release me, or maybe I will see God under the water. Seconds tick by, moments go by, it's turning into a minute, and the guru doesn't seem to be relenting. He doesn't seem to be letting him free, you know. And the disciple is now struggling, because the breath he's holding, is unable to hold it any longer. So he slowly starts releasing those air bubbles from his nose. The air is coming out, but his guru is still holding him down. The disciple suddenly realizes that half his breath is gone. He has got only half more breath. And so he starts trying to come up now, because after that he'll be gulping in water. That is when he realizes that his guru is holding him down really hard. And in his mind he thinks, oh my God, I wanted to see God, but not in this manner. You are dispatching me to the realms of death, you know, to meet my creator. This is not the way I wish to see God. And as his breath is flowing out, it is flowing out further and further, he realizes that that's it now. I mean, I don't think my guru is going to leave. I think I'm going to meet a watery grave. And that suddenly, you know, he realizes that if he doesn't do something, he's going to die. He pushes with all his strength, and suddenly, somehow, the guru's grip seems to loosen. The guru lets go. The disciple comes crashing out of the surface of the water, and, you know, he drinks in a deep breath of air and gasps and quickly takes in lungfuls of air. And then when he's little feeling better, he turns to face his guru, and he's now really upset. He turns and says, Master, what on earth were you trying to do? He says, you tell me. He says, you were trying to kill me. The guru says, no. What did I do? Why do you say that I was trying to kill you? He says, then what? You just pushed me under the water. So what happened? I thought I was going to see God, and I waited for a while. Nothing happened, and I was struggling. Why? Why? Because I was not able to breathe. And the breath I had taken was coming out. And then what happened? He says, Guru, you are making this as if it's some interesting story. What else happened? My breath was coming out, and I knew that if I didn't get air, I'm going to die. And then what happened? Then what happened? I just pushed. You should have pushed earlier then. No, I tried, but you were holding me down so strongly. Then how were you able to push me? I don't know, Guruji. I just felt I'm going to die. And I pushed, and I was able to push you, and I got air. And then the master says, therein lies the secret to seeing God. The disciple is not able to understand. He says, what are you saying, master? He says, see, when you felt that if you don't get air, you're going to die, you needed air so badly that you got the strength, you got the idea, you got the conviction, you got everything that is necessary for you to get air, and you got air. In the same way, when there comes that moment in time when you feel you need God, that is when you feel that you can't live without God, then you will be given the necessary initiative, the necessary enterprise, the necessary guidance and the necessary strength to surge ahead, breaking all barriers necessary to finally actually get God, and you will get God. That is when the disciple realizes how he had misunderstood when he said that I need God. This is what happens to most of us in our lives too. We say we need God when what we actually mean is we want God. God is desirable. It will be nice. I actually like God. It's not that I need God.
You know, this story when you narrate, I think it's probably one of the most perfect analogies for this concept of wanting God was needing God. Because I think many of us, you know, when we are stuck up in work for a long time, we've not taken an off for a couple of weeks or months. We often say this, hey, I just want to take a break and, you know, go have some fresh air. I'll go to a place where it's a short vacation, I'll catch my breath and I'll come back. You just want fresh air to fill your mind. I think that is one way of wanting God. You know, you just want to take a break from whatever you're doing. You just want, I mean, I've run after money enough. I've filled my life with people enough. Let me turn to God for some time now. I think some of us come to God like that. But at the same time, we don't realize that even as we are saying that I want a breath of fresh air, we don't realize that that is the basis of our life itself. And that is always there. It's that dual role that God plays. He is the essence of life itself. At the same time, He is also something which can be sought of as an added benefit for life too. So what are you going to choose to go after Him for? So most of us are, I think, like that. You know, we are so filled with our life. We have filled our life with so many people and things. And to top it off or to take a break from this, we want God. But as that story goes, you know, it's only when we really acknowledge that He is the basis of life itself, and it's fundamentally He whom we need more than anything else. I think only when that realization comes, Swami says, you deserve me. It is it's a good point to say this. When Swami says you deserve me, it's not that Swami will not give Himself to you unless that point comes. Because we get Swami and Swami's presence even as an act of His grace. I think all of us are like that. You know, we did not get Swami or Swami's presence, or Swami didn't come and speak to us because we really desired Swami like that, or we were desperate to Swami like that. I think as an act of grace we got it. But Swami is saying that if you want to bring it to a point where you really deserve me, that I cannot hold myself
back. Where you can actually benefit from this act of grace.
Right, and you can question me that, Swami, why you didn't come. Literally, I mean, what you deserve is a right that you can claim.
Demand, yes.
And Swami says, coming to you becomes a deservedness of yours if you need me, not when you want me.
You know, it reminds me of an episode where one of my classmates, he got an interview with Swami. And in that interview, Swami asked him, have you attended a marriage? And he said, yes, Swami. And Swami asked, who are the first people who eat in the marriage? He said, Swami, ironically, the people who are the least connected to the bride and groom, they are the ones who eat first. You know, because it happens in a marriage ceremony where if you are close to the bride or the groom, you would like to spend more time and you will be one of the last people to eat. The first people to eat will be those who are the least connected. They just come, give their wishes, have the food and go. That's how it is in Indian weddings at least. So he said, Swami, the ones who are the most distant friends and distant relatives, they are the first ones to eat food. Swami says, after that, who eats? He said, Swami, after that, actually, your friends and relatives eat. Then, Swami, after that, the ones who are closest, the closest family members, they are the ones who eat. After that, Swami, it is last that the bride and groom actually they eat. I mean, they are the most important people of the ceremony, but they are the ones who eat the last. But Swami said, are they the ones who eat last? What happens to food that remains after they eat? oh, Swami, that food, Swami, is given to all the workers and helpers who helped in, you know, the sweeper who swept the hall, everybody. So they all partake of the feast. Why should it go waste? But what happens if food is still left? Swami asked. He said, Swami, if food is still left, then Swami, I think we'll do Narayan Seva. You know, this is our flimsy concept of Narayan Seva. Remnants and what is remaining, we give away to some people and think we are feeding the Lord. Actually, Swami says Narayan Seva is when you offer even before you eat. Anyway, that's another point. But this boy said, Swami, we'll do Narayan Seva. Anybody on the road, whoever wants to eat, we feed everybody. And Swami asked, what will you do if food is still remaining? This boy ran out of all his ideas. So he said, Swami, honestly speaking, if food is still remaining, it is just thrown, Swami. It is thrown near a dustbin so that some dog or crow, you know, stray dog or crows and others can come and eat. And then Swami said something that took this boy's breath away and almost made his eyes moist. Swami said, when it comes to your love, God is like that crow and dog. You know, you go and offer your love to the ones least deserving. And you, after everyone have had their fill and then they've thrown and rejected, that also, that heart also you don't offer it to God. You just throw it and you're heartbroken. The Lord, like the dog and crow, comes and takes that heart and still, you know, becomes part of your life and showers grace on you. And then another very important statement that Swami made is, instead of that, right in the beginning, which means in your youth, if you offer your energy and love and your heart to God, Swami said, it becomes your right to demand from God whenever and at whatever point of time in life, God will have to come. It becomes your right. It's no longer just an act of grace. It is your right to demand, the right that you were referring to.
And very true. And I think more than we come to the point where we really need God, I think that's a point of desperation which, if we start talking about, we'll have to make references to saints and sages who are the ones who really epitomize that kind of craving for Swami. But the point that you made is very important. Something where we all can start from is, what is the level of importance that you give God in your life, the priority that you give God in your life? Because that's what Swami was referring to. You know, whom do you start feeding? In a simple scenario like that, who is your first guest in anything? And who gets the priority in your life? I recall, I think we must have narrated many of these incidents we're narrating. I think it's a spoiler alert. We would have narrated it so many times. But it's always wonderful to recollect some of these beautiful incidents. There's another incident which I recall. One of the, I think, visiting faculty to the management department, Swami had come up to him and Swami told him, this was sometime around the 75th birthday, I think, or the 70th, one of the big birthdays. And Swami came up to him and Swami said, hey, are you coming for Swami's birthday? So he said, yes, Swami, I'm coming. Swami said, yes, yes, get all your family and come, because it's going to be very grand. And then Swami said, I'm going to show you Vishwarupa Darshan. Right? That's something which Swami would often say for these big birthdays, because there would be a huge ocean of humanity.
There would be thousands of heads and thousands of hands.
Literally in that sense. So Swami told him, he was very happy that, you know, Swami himself is telling, come for my birthday and all that. And then he went back and he was preparing to make that trip. He was living in Bangalore. And it so happened that around Swami's birthday, or I think on Swami's birthday, there was a marriage which was scheduled in his family. Some close family member's marriage had suddenly got fixed on that day, and he had to be there. So he was really in a fix. You know, you can't miss that ceremony because he's an important member of that occasion. Mm-hmm. And here Swami himself has told him that he should come. So more or less he was kind of tilting towards attending the ceremony and skipping the marriage function. Because, you know, when you're put in situations like this, I think you think, who is more understanding on either side? You know, Swami is always more understanding, so you can deal with him rather than dealing with the relatives, right? So he kind of was gravitating towards attending the ceremony and skipping Swami's birthday when he said he had one dream one day. And Swami comes in the dream and takes him along and says, I'll take you to one place. And Swami walks him into a huge mansion, right? It's a palatial house. And Swami says, you know, this is your heart, Swami tells him. And then Swami says, there are many rooms in this mansion. And similarly, even in your heart, there are many rooms. So he said, one room is for your relatives, one room is for your children, one room is for your family, one room is for your profession and your colleagues, one room is for your friends. And then Swami told him, one room is for Swami also. So Swami said, this is how the mansion of your heart is distributed, Swami told him. So Swami then went on to tell him that if this is the place you give Swami, that is the place Swami will give you. Mm. And that's where the dream ended. And needless to say, he got up and he called up the family members immediately and said, I will not be able to attend the marriage. I'm going to Swami's birthday. But I think it starts from that. What is the priority that you're going to give Swami? And when Swami was referring to that young age and later to old age, when do you bring Swami into your life and give him that place? I think it again goes back to that. You know, when your life is filled with so many people and you are important to so many people, I think you don't think of Swami. As you grow old, I think your importance in people's lives starts fading away. Right? You know, you just become like that patriarchal figure or the matriarchal figure whom everybody looks up to and is happy to come and take blessings from. You're not involved in anything. And then your life literally starts becoming empty, and then you turn to Swami and you try to fill your life with Swami. So I think the question is, when you are important to others, when you are valuable to the society, are you making Swami valuable to you? I think that is the point really to start from, even before we come to the point of really needing Swami in that sense.
Absolutely. I think so nicely you put that point through, that God plays the role in our life that what we want him to play. You know, if you make him just one room in my mansion, that's all he'll be. But if I make him the central figure in my living room, actually if he is a living presence in every room of my mansion of life, then that is what he will also be in my life. That is, as you rightly said, it's a beginning step. It is a step that we should grow to before even we think of like needing God all the while. Dear listeners, we will continue with this very wonderful discussion after this little break. Don't go anywhere, because some more beautiful stories, some more heart-touching stories are coming up after this break.
तुम बिन मोरी कौन खबर ले, तुम बिन मोरी कौन खबर ले, गोवर्धन गिरिधारी गोवर्धन गिरिधारी हो, तुम बिन मोरी कौन खबर ले। मोर मुकुट सिर छत्र विराजे, कुंडल की छवि न्यारी ओ, मोर मुकुट सिर छत्र विराजे, कुंडल की छवि न्यारी हो, कुंडल की छवि न्यारी हो, तुम बिन मोरी कौन खबर ले, गोवर्धन गिरिधारी गोवर्धन गिरिधारी हो, तुम बिन मोरी कौन खबर ले। के प्रभु गिरधर नागर, चरण कमल पे बलिहारियो मीरा के प्रभु गिरिधर नागर चरण कमल पे बलिहारी हो चरण कमल पे बलिहारी हो तुम बिन मोरी कौन कबर ले गोवर्धन गिरिधारी गोवर्धन गिरिधारी हो तुम बिन मोरी कौन खबर ले गोवर्धन गिरिधारी गोवर्धन गिरिधारी हो तुम बिन मोरी कौन खबर ले
Welcome back, dear listeners. We were discussing on a very interesting topic, which was a statement which Swami has made. I don't know where Swami has really made that. I've not come across any discourse, but it really rings you can understand that this is definitely a sentiment which Swami speaks of, as you're saying, as we started off with that shloka from the Bhagavad Gita. And as one of the saints, Annamaya, would sing, Enta matramu evaru talachina, anta matrame nenu. What role that you want me to play, what you consider me as, that is the role I'm going to play for you in your life. So that really is this. If you really want to, as Swami would say, bind me to you, then that is how you should be able to relate to me. You should be able to make me feel that he really needs me and I should be able to come there. And that is why this statement, even though I have not personally read it anywhere in Swami's discourse or heard from Swami, he might have said, but I think it is definitely a message
on,
worth
on this note, no, Prem, I a little detour. You know, there's this famous prayer of surrender,
mm-hmm.
which has become famous in the Sai circles as a prayer that has been put up in front of the Western canteen.
Right.
You know, in fact, on the Sri Sathya Sai International website also, there is a page on prayer of surrender, and they write that this has been taken from the wall of the foreign canteen, you know. And it's so beautiful. It has been the source of solace and source of strength for so many others. So many people, including myself. I have framed this prayer of surrender and kept it in my altar. And what I felt was seeing the words, I felt that it has to be Swami's words. Because it is so inspiring, it's so beautiful. So I kept it. And as you said about, if you need me, you deserve me. It's not there in any discourse or any public talk. Only recently, you know, we were contacted by one devotee from United States of America. And she said that her grandfather and great-grandfathers were all members of the Royal Venkatagiri family. With whom we know Swami has a very long and close association, especially in the 1950s and 60s. Swami has gone there and stayed at the Venkatagiri Palace, and it's amazing. I mean, we have taken that up in part in our Satyam Shivam Sundaram Satsang series. So she had a letter that Swami had written to her father. And guess what? One was a personal letter, after which Swami had written something like a general advice and solace.
Mm-hmm.
Word to word, sentence to sentence, it matches this prayer of surrender. So sometimes, you know, in your heart already knows, though the head doesn't have a actual place or a actual reference point as to when Swami said it, where Swami said it. So I think in that sense, if you need me, you deserve me also, though we may not exactly get a discourse in which Swami has said. I remember it from a slab along the walkway when we are walking from hostel to college in Vrindavan.
Right.
There is this slab which
definitely
said,
I think Swami must have said it. The only other occasion I recall is, I think there was once a drama in Swami's presence,
mm-hmm.
On this particular theme. And they had put huge banners, if you need me, you deserve me. And it was so placed that I think in front of Swami, they had worded it like, we need you, we deserve you.
Okay.
Okay. And I think only that part of the banner which said "We deserve you" was right in front of Swami when Swami came and took his place. And Swami did appear a little disappointed seeing that. You know, it's like we looking at Swami and saying that, "Swami, we deserve you." I think that's a very, very boastful thing to say, and it's absolutely not true. As I recall another incident, you know, maybe I'll just narrate that before we move ahead, where once Swami had taken a group of students in Kodaikanal for a small outing, and something had happened, and Swami was a little put off by some small incident which had happened. So Swami came back, and Swami was not talking to anybody. Swami was to himself, and he was withdrawn. And all the students and VIPs were sitting around Swami, and we all know how important that session is when they're sitting with Swami without any public. That's the time when Swami speaks very freely, and some very beautiful anecdotes are shared. And they were kind of feeling that they're missing out that because Swami is so withdrawn on that day. So one of the VIPs thought that let's strike a conversation. And he said, "Swami, we don't know what we have done to deserve this opportunity of being in Swami's presence." So Swami was contemplative, and Swami said, And then here another VIP took on from there and said, "Swami, I'm sure we have not done anything in this life worthwhile for this opportunity. I mean, we have not done anything to really deserve this. Maybe in some past life we would have done." And Swami said, And then someone else took on from there and said, "Swami, not just us. Our ancestors and great ancestors, all of them must have done for so many lifetimes, and that is what has brought us this opportunity." Then Swami kept quiet after that. So then they realized that it's no point in taking this any further because Swami was so quiet. Then after some time, Swami started on a different note. Swami said, "Have you heard of all these saints and sages who have done tapas for many years?" So they said, "Yes, Swami, we've read in books." So then Swami said, "They sometimes meditate for decades together, and some of them even centuries together, for one glimpse of God." And then, you know, so very profoundly Swami told, "When I go to give them darshan, I give them darshan for a few minutes." And Swami didn't say that when Lord Vishnu goes or Lord Shiva goes. Swami says, "When I go and give them darshan, I give them for a few minutes." Then Swami said, "You fellows get to spend the entire day with me. And some of you, you're in your own cities doing your own work, in your own jobs. You feel like seeing Swami, you catch a bus, you come and see Swami. And you get to spend so much time with Swami. Do you think you all deserve this?" And then Swami said, "Not one of you in front of me has done enough merit to even get 1 minute in my presence." And then Swami said that, you know, it's just that you all have done some good in your past. Okay, and that good has given you this opportunity because, you know, it's coincided with the time the avatar is on earth. But none of you ever deserve this opportunity. Never, you know, give yourself to this misunderstanding. And then, you know, of course, Swami went on to say that that's not the saddest part. The saddest part is not one of you is utilizing one moment in Swami's presence. And then, you know, Swami said, "Don't put up these fake humility in front of me. You say, 'No, Swami, we have not done anything good to deserve this. You know, we have not done in all our life.' But then you don't want to let go of the, the chance of associating yourself with the opportunity." Then you say, "Not in this birth, we must have done in some other birth. Or our ancestors would have done." You know, as though saying that we don't want to let go of this pride of owning it up. So we said, "You have not done, neither have your ancestors done, and neither have you done in any birth to deserve this opportunity." So, I mean, I recollected that because when you say that we deserve you, I think no one else can say that other than Swami. And he will see that only on the basis of what we were talking about. You know, do you really need him in that sense?
I think the only thing we can tell is how badly we need him, that's all.
Right.
The deserving part, he will decide. And, you know, going back to the definition where we say need is when you feel that without it you will die. That is a need. Very often our needs are food and clothing and shelter and money, and because we think that without this our life is not a life. Because for us life is not just about being alive and breathing, it's about being alive. You know, you get the pump of adrenaline, you get to see the world, you get your desires fulfilled, you get all that. That is what is meant by being alive. Otherwise, you just have life and you're as good as dead. That's how it's considered. And that is the reason I think we go pursuing all this. But there come those points in time when suddenly you realize that none of my money, none of my relations, none of my wealth, none of my influence, nothing can ever come to my aid? That is when I realize that all those are not actually needs, and what I need now is God. You know, I'm reminded of the experience of Mr. Devesh Srivastava. He is the younger brother of Dr. Sailesh Srivastava,
right,
whom we have spoken about many times, who is our head of the Prashanti Music Group here, one of the in-charges. He's composed 80 to 90% of the songs and kavalis and shlokas that have been sung in Bhagwan's presence. He has been associated with so many convocation dramas. He's a brilliant physicist. It's amazing. His life experiences are so amazing, and I don't mind saying here to our listeners that if you get a chance to be in Prashanthi Nilayam and visit the bookstore, please do buy the book entitled Swami, Guruji and I. It is an autobiographical account by Dr. Sailesh Srivastava. It's in two parts. It's amazing. Anyway, coming back to Devesh Srivastava. Now, we call Sailesh Srivastava as Sailesh Sir. So Sailesh Sir and his parents, they were fully into the spiritual path, into Swami, while this brother Devesh was not into that. And therefore, he inherited all of his father's business. His father had a talc mining business, one of the largest in North India, possibly the largest in India as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing extremely well, and it was Devesh's idea that he wants to, you know, spread it all across India, grow the business even more, and tremendous amount of money, resources and things involved, influence involved in this. So he was the sole inheritor of all this, and he was doing all of this pretty well, pretty good, and everything was going on fine. He was so happy. And one day, you know, NS Corporation, that was the company then, he had to travel from Almora to I forget the name of the place where this NS Corporation is headquartered in Uttar Pradesh. So he was traveling there, and it's all a hilly region. And when he was traveling in the car with two other friends, he was in the front passenger seat. The car was at a good speed, and a curve came on the road. One side is the mountain, the other side is the gorge. And this friend seemed to be pretty confident of navigating this curve at high speed itself. But as he was navigating the curve, they realized that it was not a C curve, but a U curve.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it is much more, you know, much more than what they anticipated. And therefore, the car went out of control, and it was sure that it is going to go over the ledge and into the gorge. And that is when, you know, in that fraction of a second, possibly when Devesh realized that nothing in his life is going to help him now, because he's going to die. So he just cried out, "Oh God, no, oh God, help me." He just cried out that much. And the car was about to fly off. But imagine their luck that there is one solitary tree
mm-hmm.
on the ledge, and the car goes and slams into the tree. And therefore is not thrown off into the gorge. It remains on top, but it's battered. And Devesh could feel a million stings on his face. You know, the glass had shattered, and his full face, chest, everything was covered in blood. He lay there in the pool of blood. His other two friends were also knocked off, you know, by the impact. They were not as badly injured, because he was on the side of the tree. But his injury was grievous, and he was sure he's going to die. You know, this was literally the case when they say something that you need to survive, something that you feel that you need, without which you can't survive, that is a need. That is exactly the situation he was in. He was sure that he's not going to survive, because the nearest hospital he knows is about an hour and a half away, not 100 kilometers, it's about 40 kilometers away. But in the hilly region, it takes an hour and a half to get there. There's nobody inside, there's nothing to help him, and he's just bleeding away to death. He was sure he'll die. And he says, interestingly, that is the point in time when he recollected his Balvikas days. You know,
mm-hmm.
See, this Balvikas is the period when children are, you know, educated. Yeah. In the Satisai organization system of education, Balvikas is what the young ones are taken to, and seeds of devotion and love planted. And though he had left it, those seeds had actually sprouted, and he said he remembered his Balvikas days. And he just prayed out, telling God, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. I need you. Come and save me. Says that desperate prayer he had never made. And to his amazement, at that moment, he could see one Maruti van coming and stopping and some lady screaming that, oh my God, I think this person will die. And he says, Sardarji, a person from Punjab, he got down, he was very hefty, strong, and he came. He opened up his turban. A Sardarji always wears a turban. Mm-hmm. He took out his turban and began to bandage his face, and he says, he was almost losing consciousness, and every part of his body was aching. The moment they lifted him, he felt like jolts of electric shocks coursing through his body. They put him in the back of a Maruti van. You can imagine, it's a small van. It doesn't have such good shock absorbers. And they decided to transport him to the hospital. Devesh was sure that he's not going to survive. And he says, at that moment, when he was praying to Swami, he says he hears a voice. He has never come regularly for Swami's darshan or anything like that. He hears a voice which tells him, do the Gayatri Mantra. Do the Gayatri Mantra. Chant Gayatri Mantra. And he says that he chanted Gayatri Mantra thrice. And as he chanted it thrice, he says, the back of the Maruti van gets transformed into Prashanti Nilayam, and he's seeing Swami standing there with his hand raised in Abhaya Hasta. And as this vision fades, to his utter shock, you know, pleasant shock, he's already in the hospital. A 1.5 hour journey of 45 kilometers gets reduced to three Gayatris and one Darshan.
Mm-hmm.
One vision. And it all went fine. See, that I feel is possibly a moment in time when you think that you need so many things in life, as you were saying. Each one's needs varies because we think we need it. And so many things become your need. You think that without that you won't be able to survive. But when the actual moment of reckoning comes, when you're actually going to die, that is when possibly you get a realization of what you truly need. Just like how Parikshit was a ruler, he was everything. He wanted so many things, but the moment he got to know that he has got 7 days to live, his focus was only on the story and glory of God. I think it's a wise man who can learn from others' experience. Why do we think that our experience will be any different? Why do we think that when we are going to die and the moment of reckoning comes, we might possibly have some other need? Experience and history shows that irrespective of who the person is, whether he's a king or an industrialist or a poor man, when the end comes, what everyone needs is just the same thing. Wouldn't it be wise on our part to start practicing towards growing that need further and yearning for that now itself?
Even as you're saying that, I'm reminded of another story. I know that the story that you're narrating is not complete, but maybe I'll break in and tell something which is quite similar. You know, what you said about that experience, which shows us that what are the things we really need, and, you know, now is the time when you can do anything of value. It's not worthwhile to put it away till later.
Mm.
This was narrated by one of our lecturers in the university, Dr. Chandrasekhar, whom we refer to as Dr. Chase. Mm. He was in a very, very good job in Australia. I think he was working for IBM or something. And his wife was in a very good job. They had made a lot of money. They did not have children. So eventually they come to know of Swami. I mean, that's a long story in itself, how he is drawn by the service that the organization was doing there, and then eventually Swami draws him individually, and the couple become very devoted to Swami and all that. He says that for many years he's been going to the center, he becomes a service coordinator and all that, but he did not have that personal connect with Swami. Swami did not become that personal God for him, though he had become that for his wife. So he said that a particular incident happened after which, you know, he gave Swami that position in his life. And then after that, when he went back to Australia, he said, there's no point in me staying here. See, if I acknowledge that this is Swami and he is God, then, I mean, I shouldn't be here. I should be around him. I should do whatever it takes to be with him all the time. So he wanted to immediately quit his job, and he wanted to take his wife and come and resettle in Parthi. But for some reason, his wife was not ready for that. And she said, no, we have settled here well, and, you know, we can keep visiting Parthi twice or thrice a year. And she was in that kind of a thing. And he did not want to hurry her up. He said, you know, let it be a mutual decision. And so he prayed to Swami. He said, Swami, this is my desire. This is what I want to do. But you know, I leave it to you to convince my wife and we can go. So he speaks of this incident which happens where they go for a concert. I think it's a dance recital or something like that. And his wife is sitting next to him in that auditorium. And suddenly she starts complaining of breathlessness. She says, I'm not able to breathe. And so he tells her that maybe you're feeling very suffocated in this closed auditorium.
Claustrophobic.
So let's just go out, take a walk and come back. So even as he was saying this, she collapsed. Her head fell back and her mouth opened wide and she started turning pale. So they got really scared and he said, you know, he just could not do anything. He could not react. And he was saying, I mean, that was a different line of thought. He felt very bad that he could not think of Swami then, right? You know, in the most important time, he was not able to even recollect Swami and Swami's name or whatever it is. And because he was so flat, you know, that's the only person who matters to you in your life. And that's what's happening to her. So immediately the friends got together. They called up the emergency services. They laid her on the floor there and they were trying to resuscitate her or something. Nothing worked. But after some time, after about 10 minutes, she got up on her own. You know, she gasped a huge wallop of breath and she got up and she looked around. And the first thing she said was, Sairam.
Oh my God.
Okay, wow. She just got up from the thing and said, Sairam, she said. So they were all very happy and they immediately rushed her to the hospital and admitted her there. And the doctor said, we'll do tests through the night. And he went home and he wanted to come back the next morning and find out what was there. So when he came to the hospital, he saw his wife standing outside with her bag. And he said, what happened? Why did they discharge you? They said they didn't find anything wrong. Everything seems to be normal. So they just said unexplained phenomena and they sent me away. So he was happy. He took her home. And after they went home, the first thing the wife says is, I think we need to shift to Puttaparthi. Okay, and he says, what happened? I mean, did you have a vision or something? He said, no. I mean, that one moment, what happened to me, I realized that life is so fleeting. He said, anything could happen to this life. So if we feel that something has to be done, it has to be done now, not later. And she said, if we want to live with Swami, it is now. We cannot delay it any further. So that idea, you know, when death is staring at your face, that is the most important thing. That question of the story with which we started the Chinnakatha. I mean, when you are really desperate, what is that that you will seek for? If that is God, seek Him now. Don't wait for later.
I think that is a message all of us should take home, because at least Parikshit had the luxury of knowing that he has got only 7 more days. We don't know. We don't know whether we are going to be alive after 7 more minutes. Death can stare at our face at any moment. And rather than taking that as a discouraging and depressing thought, I think that's a very empowering thought, because it forces us to start focusing on what is the top priority in our life and not waste anything. Swami always says, don't waste time, don't waste money, don't waste food, don't waste
energy,
yes, yeah. Don't waste any of these, time and energy especially. They're very, very important. So we should not waste on all these. And keeping in mind this concept of death, I think, keeps us always on alert, focusing on our top priority, ensures that we don't get lost in other things. You know, just for the sake of completion, the message was complete in that story, but just for the sake of completion of the story, which is so beautiful, when this accident actually happened, Devesh's mother, Aarti auntie, she also works in the primary school. At that time, she was working in the primary school, and so she called up her elder son, that is Silesh sir, in the school, and interestingly and coincidentally, at that very moment, Silesh sir was taking a parayanam. You know, he was talking about Swami to all the students. And can you believe what was the theme of his parayanam? It was disasters or problems or whatever happens, what we think is a tragedy, are actually opportunities that God picks to enter our life. No, that is what he was speaking on. Mm-hmm. And he was called aside because there was a phone call for him. The phone call was from his mother and she said, look, your brother has been involved in such a big accident. It's such a big tragedy. Please tell Swami. Please tell Swami, because he's very serious. He needs stitches. And she told him that he is going to need 180 stitches to his face. 180 stitches. To the face, just imagine, it's not 5 or 6, it's 180 full. The only positive thing about that is possibly the number 1 plus 8 adds up to 9. You know, other than that, there's nothing positive in that. So, Sailesh sir said that, see, I don't know if I will get this opportunity to speak to Swami, but Swami, this was the time of the convocation dramas, and so he said Swami is calling us in for interview every evening, so tomorrow evening I'll tell. She said, can't you tell him tomorrow morning at least, you know, because morning will possibly be the operation and all that. He said, that's not in my hand. If Swami calls, then I can tell him. Again, interestingly, the next day morning, Swami, during darshan, asked for Sailesh sir and some of the members of the drama and called them inside the interview room. And Sailesh sir says that possibly in his entire span across convocation dramas, this was just the two or one occasion when Swami had called them in the morning, and this was one of those. And so Swami asked him, so what are you doing? What is happening? And as always, he told about the progress of the drama, the songs being composed and all that, because he didn't want to, you know, distract Swami from what Swami is wanting to speak about. But Swami himself said, my brother got into an accident, right? Very serious one. And Sailesh sir assumed that, you know, possibly when Swami came for the morning darshan, my mother must have given him a letter or told him that. That's what he thought. And then Swami said, see, it's his karma. What to do? All the karma, it had to be cleared. But then, it'll all be fine, Swami assured him. So he nodded to that. And Swami said, you know how many stitches he got? So Sailesh sir knew it, of course, because his mother has told him. Swami then said, 102 stitches, Swami said. Now Sailesh sir thought, Swami, actually, yeah, you're getting amazed at 102 because it's 180, how much? But he didn't say anything, he just left it at that. And Swami said, your mother wants to go to see him? He nodded, Sailesh sir nodded, said, yes, Swami, she wants to go. Swami said, yeah, take this vibhuti, give it to her, let her go. So Sailesh sir came out of the, that was the end of the interview, and after the session, he met up his mother, and his mother told that Swami, while walking back, actually looked towards her and told her that you can go. So she was happy. And Sailesh sir also didn't ask her what she had told Swami or anything, just gave her the vibhuti. He just assumed that his mother would have told Swami about all this. Much later, month later, actually Devesh came to Puttaparthi. You know, once he was fit and fine, the first thing he did was to come to Puttaparthi. Because once you have an experience like this, you realize what is it that you need in life. Everything else becomes secondary. As Swami told one student who is into business, mm-hmm. who had a similar kind of life and death experience. You know, his name is Pragyat from Mumbai. He said, Swami, enough of business, Swami. I don't want any of this. What matters is you. I'm going to come here and stay with you. At that time, Swami told him, see, till now you're doing full-time business and part-time devotion. From today onwards, do full-time devotion and part-time business. Don't give it up. Go back. So he continues to do it, and he says, with this thing. So that is how it happens, you know. So even for Devesh, he realized that I'm going to possibly do my business as part-time, but this is the goal in my life. So he came. That is when, you know, he revealed all that had happened to Sailesh sir. Sailesh sir had no idea about all this vision of Swami and the Gayatri Mantra. You know, that, as an aside, shows the power of the Gayatri Mantra. If I may be allowed, just a few days back, I was reading in a book called The Avatar's Prescriptions mm-hmm. by Dr. Vijay Kumar, an anesthetist who has been involved in Swami's healthcare mission in Chennai, in the city of Chennai particularly, for more than 4 decades. He writes of an interview in which Swami was consoling a little girl.
Okay.
And Swami said that I'm consoling her and talking to her because her father died in the Air India crash, Kanishka.
Mm-hmm.
Kanishka was an Air India Jumbo Jet.
Jumbo.
An Air India Jumbo Jet that was exploded midair over Ireland, you know, mm-hmm. by terrorists. And everybody on board had died. And why I'm telling this is, he narrates that after the interview, Swami turned towards them and said, there were more than 250 passengers on board that aircraft. Even none of them chanted the Gayatri Mantra. Even if one had chanted, the accident would have been averted. I mean, that is the power of the Gayatri Mantra. It's very interesting that even this person, Devesh, was told by the voice, chant the Gayatri Mantra. So that is when he told Sailesar that, you know, they did 102 stitches to my face. And Sailesar was not dumbstruck because he thought that he knew the correct number. And of course, without anybody telling him, Swami knows everything. But when he reveals his divinity like that, it always stuns us into silence.
Absolutely. I think these couple of stories tell us a lot of things. You know, if we are going to ask ourselves, how do we know that we really deserve Swami, and how do we know that when Swami comes, is it our deservedness or our grace? It's very difficult to say, but the journey towards the point where you really need Swami is, as we said in the beginning, giving Him importance. And the more and more we start giving Him the place that He deserves in our life, I think at that point when we really need Him, it goes without saying that you don't have to really think of Swami. He makes you think of Him. I mean, that Brother Devesh's experience, I don't think he possibly thought that, okay, now I need God. You know, Swami appearing there and says, do this. This is what you need right now. I think it's a sign that when you have, at least at some point, given Swami that place, when you've done the right things, it need not necessarily be acts of devotion. It's not about how many hours of bhajans you've sat through or how many hours of meditation you've done.
The attitude.
Right. The giving Swami the place of devotion, and as Swami says, being good. I mean, that is as much part of the act of devotion than anything else. Doing the right things, being righteous, having led a clean life. I think all of that adds to that one point when Swami says that, yeah, now you need my grace, I'm coming to you. And I recall another beautiful incident which T.G. Krishnamurti sir used to narrate, the former state president of Tamil Nadu, where he narrates of a similar accident he was a part of, where I think he and his family were traveling. I don't recall the details. A very bad accident where, you know, I think all of them should have succumbed to the injuries had they sustained them. And he was narrating how that thing happened. And I think the car flew and it landed without having any damage to it, or things like that. And he was narrating this in Swami's presence once in Trai Vrindavan. And Swami looked at him and said, no, I did not save you. And he said, Swami, it's impossible that you did not save me, because there was no other way I would have survived that accident. And Swami said, no, I did not save you. And then Swami went on to say that you have done so much good all your life. You've been part of so many seva activities that when you needed it, my grace did not wait for my approval also. It came rushing to help you. And it's almost like the good that you did came and saved you. It did not need me to come there at all. So I think that is the level of deservedness where, you know, you're encashing your grace even without a moment's delay or moment's approval. You don't even have to go through the bureaucracy to get what you need to get.
So on that note, dear listeners, we will take another quick break. On the other side of the break, there's one more very interesting insight and point that we would like to discuss. So don't go anywhere. We'll be back after the break to discuss that very point before concluding this topic on If You Need Me, You Deserve Me.
Tum bin praan nahi, o sai mere. बिन प्राण नहीं ओ साईं मेरे सब भक्तों का तुम हो सहारा Thank you. साई भगवान। साई भगवान तुम बिन प्राण नहीं हो साई मेरे, सब भक्तों का तुम हो सहारा,
welcome back dear listeners. We will continue our discussion on If You Need Me, You Deserve Me. There's one interesting aspect of need and survival that's connected to the human brain. The brain of every animal is programmed in a manner that it ensures survival of that being. So too is a human brain, it's no different. And therefore, the human brain does everything that it needs to do for the survival. For the survival of the self. For the survival of the human being. But one thing special that a human being has, which none of the other animals have, is this ability to think, the ability to discriminate, something that's called the mind or the manas. And as we had done that entire satsang on the manas consists of buddhi, chitta, manas, buddhi, chitta and ahankara. This four-functioned complex is what we call as the mind, and manas is the active mind. The buddhi is the discriminatory mind, the chitta is the memory mind, right. While ahankara is the mind which is associated with self-concept, what we think of ourselves. And it's on this ahankara part of our association of what we think of ourselves that we would like to discuss a little, because, you know, as Prem pointed out the other day so beautifully, when we say that the brain or we do everything that we need to do for our survival, what we do totally depends on who we think we are. If I think of myself as the body, I will do all that is necessary for the preservation and sustenance of the body. If I think of myself as the mind, I will do everything that is necessary for the preservation and sustenance of the mind. So on and so forth. Therefore, when we say that we are programmed to do all that is necessary for our survival, because what connects is a need is defined as something that we do for our survival, and what we do for our survival depends on who we think we are. I think this is a very, very interesting and profound thought that we need to discuss a little more on.
Very true. I think very extensive study in itself in neurosciences, because if you look at the brain itself, they say that the central part of the brain is referred to as the reptilian brain, which means it's common between mammals, advanced mammals like humans, then the lower mammals, probably the cows and the horses, and even the reptiles. And that is like the basic animal brain, which we refer to as the one which does this task of self-preservation. right? But we will look at the human brain, as we know from the shape of the brain itself, that frontal lobes, which actually the ones which are different from the any other brains that you see in mammals also, is the place where you have the idea of morality, our place in society, our place in a family, and all of those complex understandings which you probably won't find in animals. Right? That is what enhances this idea of what we call self. Because I think one of the studies which people have done is this tendency to end one's own life, to commit suicide, is probably completely contrary to this idea of self-preservation. How can a brain come up with the idea of ending one person's life when the brain itself is made up for
self-preservation? Right. Yes. So I don't think any animal commits suicide.
Right, that's why when they go into the study of any animals, they find that almost no other animal has this trait of killing oneself because one did not achieve one thing, or the idea of honor being taken away and you killing, like, you know, you have honor killing, or you have people killing themselves. You have the sad plight of farmers killing themselves when they're not able to repay loans.
Depression killing people.
Right. So that kind of a phenomena you don't see in the animal kingdom. So it's very paradoxical that the brain, which is meant for self-preservation, can think of self-extermination due to something. And I think the answer to that is the idea of self is much larger than just the body. Though we are all, you know, centrally attached to this body, and the body consciousness is the basis of everything that we think I am, it is still a very small part. That's why when the idea of that larger self, which is larger than the body, gets affected in some manner, I think in the process of trying to preserve that, the human brain says it's okay to let go of this physical body, which is only a small part of that entire idea of self.
And it's not just the negative examples, Prem. When we look at the examples what Swami gives us of Raja Harishchandra, you know, for the sake of upholding the truth, he was ready to undergo great pain and suffering, loss of kingdom, loss of, you know, physical suffering, sleeping on the streets. So if the concept of self was just of the body, definitely one would not have made the body suffer so much, and even the mind suffer so much. You know, that is where we come to the quote that Swami says, you are not one but three. The one that you think you are, the one that others think you are, and the one that you really are. I think if we have to go to positive examples, that positive examples come when you associate with what you really are. That is the reason why a person like a Raja Harishchandra is able to give up all bodily comforts and pleasures, all mental comforts and pleasures. You know, from a normal, sane human being point of view, we feel that whatever Raja Harishchandra did was stupidity. That is why you and me and any common person feels that the greatest ideals that Swami portrays is impractical. And that, whether we accept it or not, is because we are associating ourselves with something lower than what we really are. That is why that looks impractical. And it feels like, why would I destroy myself for that sake? When I realize that I am not this, what I am is actually that. It is when I am not following truth, when I am not following dharma, when I am not following shanti and prema, that is when I am actually destroying myself for something that is not myself. That kind of feeling will come only when I am able to associate myself with what I truly am. And therefore I feel if we have to grow to that point of needing Swami, that we will be able to do only when we realize who we truly are. If we associate ourselves, if our self-concept is that of who we truly are. Because unless we associate with that, we will not feel the need for God. We will feel that we need food more than God. We need sleep more than God. We need relationships, power, money, influence more than God. Because we think of ourselves as either the body or the mind. The moment we are able to truly identify ourselves with who we really are, I think needing God will be an automatic byproduct or result.
Very true. In fact, Swami himself says this, you know, you very rightly said, even the idea of selflessness actually comes from this idea of me being larger than the body, what we do as seva, as sacrifice. All of that also comes with, that's another thing which confuses people who study science of human thinking. Because you don't find this idea of self-abnegation also in any other life form. Of one denying oneself of comfort and food and giving it to another person. So even that holy idea comes from this. and as Swami would say, you know, in both cases, to an extent, it is giving up a body consciousness. Even when you're talking about the idea of suicide, to an extent, it is not completely, we're not endorsing that. But as Swami would say that, you know, it's not enough if you just give up body consciousness. In a discourse, Swami was jocularly saying that if you drink a bottle of wine, you'll give up body consciousness.
Correct.
Right? You'll get intoxicated, you'll forget you're the body, you lose all sense of decorum and culture, and you keep saying all kinds of nonsense. So Swami is saying it's not just about giving up body consciousness, but as the Dehabhimanam is given up, Atmabhimanam has to be cultivated. So as you were saying, it is that concerted process which is what will take us there. And very beautifully you said, you know, it might sound a little confusing when you say that the more you go closer to your true self, you'll become more devoted. Because the one is about Advaita related thing where you don't relate devotion in that aspect. But when you talk about yearning for Swami and needing Swami, it's about devotion. But it's about the priority. What Swami would say is, you realize that that's the fundamental need and the fundamental goal of life. To find fulfillment in that merger with Swami. And Swami would say, dharma, artha, kama, moksha. When you realize that I am following dharma for moksha, I'm, you know, the greatest artha that I can have is that which leads me towards moksha, and the best desire I can entertain is the desire for moksha. So you kind of prime yourself entirely for that goal, and that is when he becomes not only the top priority but also the only need in that sense.
I would just like to add 2 points to what you said. One is regarding that, you know, when you commit suicide, you're actually giving up body consciousness, but that's not enough, you said. Because you said, as you give up Dehabhimana, you have to get Atmabhimana. I feel when it comes to the case of suicide, it is usually, you're giving up body consciousness, no doubt, but that is because of the stress and strain from, if I can coin that term, mind consciousness, or psychological consciousness. It's not that I'm associating myself with the Atma. I'm associating myself with my mind.
It's very complex. Maybe we should say that. Let's not people go away with ideas. Because Swami says that when you trouble your body in any way, you're also emphasizing the idea that I believe I'm the body. So it's a complex thing. It's not purely this and not that.
Exactly. That was one point. The other point that I wanted to state was when you said about if I am growing in Advaita, we often think that I can't grow in Bhakti. I feel the greatest example we can take is of Adi Shankaracharya. Because when you ask anybody to name an Advaitin, I'm sure in the top three, definitely Adi Shankaracharya will come. And if you look at Adi Shankaracharya's life, I think Mudakarata Modakam and so many Ashtakams, Shatakams, you know, he has composed them. He has composed it, and this is something that is totally related to bhakti. At the same time, he lived only to an age of 32 physically. Before that age, 2 times he has traversed the length and breadth of the Indian subcontinent, you know. He has gone from south to north, west to east. Just imagine. Just only the walking he has done, because those days there were no motor vehicles or anything like that, and he didn't go on horseback. He just did walking. So that's a lot of work, actual work, karma. So I don't think we can classify Adi Shankara as an Advaitin who stuck only to Jnana Marga or Jnana Yoga, because he has done a lot of karma, he has done a lot to the Bhakti Marga. It's amazing, and therefore we realize that as we progress on any path that we choose, whether it's karma, bhakti or jnana, the other two automatically get reinforced and strengthened, and at the point of culmination, we are at the height of all the three, karma, bhakti and jnana. It's not like I'm on the peak of karma and I've got no jnana, or I've got no love for God, or I'm on the peak of jnana and I have no love for God. Whether I'm on the peak of jnana, whether I'm on the peak of bhakti, whether I'm on the peak of karma, I am on the other peaks as well, because though we may not realize it at this point in time, it is the same peak. These are just three different pathways leading to the top.
Right. And maybe as a summary of what we've been speaking, I think it all comes from that. The question is, when we narrate incidents where Swami comes to the rescue of people at the moment when they need it the most in that sense, always the question of what about the others who did not have that same blessing. For every person to whom Swami comes to rescue, I think there are many, many others whom probably Swami does not come to at that point or in the form that we think that he has to come to, in the form of a rescue, in the form of an extension of life or whatever it is. I think the way we need to look at it is, you know, what can we do? This is probably the dictum which Swami has given, that if you need me, you deserve me. The thing is, you can't need him at one particular time and you can't not need him at the other times in your life.
Mm-hmm.
You need to lead your life in such a way that you need him at every moment, at a time when it is critical and the time when it's non-critical too.
Because otherwise then it's not a need. The right. need by itself means that if something is absent, you can't survive.
Right. And then the moment you give him that priority or that importance in life, I think it'll show in the decisions that you make. It'll show in the way you lead your life. As Swami would say, that you cannot love me and lead a life which is immoral or unrighteous. So in that sense, when the moment you start giving Swami that importance, he will automatically start defining the kind of choices that you make, the kind of path that you take in your life. And that is how you say that, Swami, I could take other decisions and become richer. I can take other decisions and become more authoritative and powerful in life. But I'm choosing that decision which is going to which is going to stamp the idea that I'm giving you more importance. I think that's how you automatically start giving importance to Swami. And it, without your knowledge, I think you will come to a point where Swami is the top priority and the top need in your life. And when that happens, Swami says, even I cannot stop you. When you have a need, I will have to come to you. Or the other way of looking at it probably is, maybe we can spend a couple of minutes talking about it, is let us take it that we are already there. You know, that is one way of approaching things, the positive reinforcement. You believe that you're already there. If we believe that way, that tomorrow if I have a problem and say, Swami, I want you to come and help me. And if Swami does not come and help me, we'll have to go back to that definition we started with. A need is something that we cannot do without. So if Swami does not come to my rescue, it means at that moment what I thought was a need was not a need, but it was only a superfluous desire which probably thought it's better to let go of.
That's wonderful. We can actually use that statement itself to define what is a need. Because as you rightly said, if it is a need, then definitely God is going to respond. And if at all I feel God has not responded, then maybe it's not a need. Yes, that is a very wonderful note to end this satsang on. I think that's a point to ponder. And dear listeners, we would love to have your feedback on this point. And as always, if we get sufficient thoughts and ideas, maybe we will have a satsang on that too. But this idea that when I am in need, I pray to God, and God doesn't answer. And when God doesn't seem to answer, maybe it means that what I'm praying is not my need. Because Swami has promised, if at all you have needed it, you'll deserve it. Maybe I'm not getting it because I don't need it. It's not about my deservedness. It's about me not needing it. And it's time for me to grow, because it's not a need. It's only a want that is got disguised as a need. On that note and on that thought, dear listeners, we would like to bring this satsang to a close, offering it at the lotus feet of our beloved Bhagwan. As always, you can write to us at listener@radiosai.org. We hope you enjoyed this as much as both of us enjoyed it over here. We will end now with a song or a bhajan, the other side of which, as always, you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu with his segment, Love to Love.
तेरे सर दिखाओ रस बुझाओ साई मेरे तेरे सर दिखाओ रस बुझाओ मेरे दिल को मैंने मंदिर बनाया आओ बसा दो भगवान।